25% discount.
In the last few days, the Sun, the Mail...
And sin, burn and boil, seethe and scald, combust and crackle, until we are inflamed, roasted, toasted, grilled,
and cauterized, until our bones crumble into that demoniac heat, that fire, that Hades, that realm of Pluto, that unblessed limbo, that purgatory. Tartarus. Gentlemen, hellfire! Hellfire! Let the wenching begin!
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is it about some obscure pastor Erdogan's locked up? What's really behind the economic war now raging between the US and Turkey? Yes, further than NATO, from NATO every day, while all the focus is on this little-known US pastor arrested at the US coup attempt 2 years ago. So what is, and who is, really behind this latest breakdown in relations? And what's Erdogan and Turkey's position with the conflicts brewing? And already happened in Syria and the Middle East. Also, we seem to be starting a series of Get to Know the Israeli Cabinet. Last week it was Justice Minister Eilat Shaked. This week we have a listen to Homeland Security Minister Gilad Erdan, who explains what he believes is the logic behind his anti-terror strategy. And further east, we look at the mind control, yes, and extreme surveillance in China, which is overtaking the UK as the world's big brother state. Also, the slow crushing of free speech in Hong Kong, while the Chinese military do their biggest exercises ever off the coast there. The UN this week criticised China's so-called re-education camps, which are trying to wean a million of China's mainly Muslim Uyghurs off the Quran and onto President Xi's Little Red Book. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, an exclusive look at the effects of 8 straight years of austerity, with real wages falling while rents go up and up. More people are moving into vehicles and caravans. Are we seeing the start of a second traveller revolution, like the one Margaret Thatcher crushed, or tried to, at the 1985 Battle of the Beanfield? Author of the book of the same name, Andy Worthington, joins me, along with Sean, who was an HGV mechanic on the legendary Convoy. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. But Martin, we start this week by looking at Turkey particularly. Can we just put this whole thing into context? And why is Turkey such an important country when it comes to the conflicts that have been going on in Iraq and Syria?
Well, I mean, they refused to allow their bases to be used in the invasion of Iraq. In fact, so Incirlik couldn't be used. Well, Turkey's a very important country because of its geographical position. and it's a swing country like Egypt perhaps was in the Cold War. So it's a very, you know, it's because of its geographical position that it's so important, and that you know what happens there, you know, is very important for what happens elsewhere, nearby and further away. But of course, most people in the West are blissfully unaware that as part of NATO, NATO has imposed a series of military governments on Turkey, and when the military seized power in 1980 in Turkey, there was massive terrorism going on, left wing terrorism, right wing terrorism, loads of people being killed. Then the military took over, and it all magically stopped, and that's because NATO were running the terrorism and they also ran the military government. And then the military government in 1980 in Turkey actually imposed the first International Monetary Fund Structural Adjustment Programme, which was the beginning of the Reagan-Thatcher revolution in the Third World. But it was put through by a military government which came to power having orchestrated, and there's lots of people in Turkey who've investigated this, orchestrated the terrorism which then brought them to power, because that's what NATO does, and we're part of NATO. NATO's a terrorist organisation.
Well, certainly they are certainly involved in wars and that sort of thing. But
no, they're involved in terrorism as well, Tony. In Turkey, everybody knows it.
The main thing about Turkey is it's actually the second largest country in NATO.
Well, it's got the biggest army in NATO and so on, whether if they're going to stay in NATO or whatever. It's a very important country, and of course they were working very closely with the British intelligence services and the US intelligence services to run jihadis into Syria, including Al-Qaeda, in order to overthrow Bashar al-Assad,
so
but
why,
they failed.
Why has Erdogan got rid of various newspapers like he did last year? I mean, it doesn't sound like he's very secure in his position if he's closing down newspapers and getting... I mean, he actually had the police come in and shut down one of the newspapers, didn't he?
He did. And Erdogan is not necessarily a liberal, but on the other hand, he has got popular support inside Turkey. People who think that he's a dictator are missing the point. He's got popular support, particularly in rural areas and the poorer urban areas.
So why has he locked up 50,000 Turks then?
Because there was a military coup in which hundreds of people died, Tony. And of course, it didn't succeed, but he's not very happy about it. And of course, NATO was behind that military coup. We were behind that military coup. Erdogan is the elected leader. The PKK, who are political enemies of Erdogan and also military enemies of Erdogan, because they went back to war after ISIS bombed one of their rallies some years ago now, they opposed the military coup against them because they said, we're not having the Americans decide who runs Turkey, and we support Erdogan, we want to negotiate with him. Now Erdogan is I'm not very fond of him. He was actually supporting, his son was supporting ISIS, as Putin pointed out, when the Russian Air Force started bombing all of these tankers that were taking oil out of ISIS-controlled territory via Turkey to be resold onto the world market, mostly to the Israelis, as it happens. And, of course, what's happened is that Turkey is run by a right-wing Islamist dictatorship, which was fine when it was aligned with NATO, but now, of course, becomes a terrible country that we've all got to wag our fingers at. Now they're starting to be unaligned with NATO. But, of course, the Turks should never have been in NATO. They were fools to join it.
Well, all this criticism of the Turks, particularly for the arrest of 50,000 people. The article today by Robert Fisk is in the Independent and I think in the IA newspaper. It says a US trade war with Turkey over a little known pastor. Robert Fisk is advising us not to believe a word of it, and he's pointing out that Egypt's president and Field Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has broken Erdogan's record by banging up 60,000 supposed Islamists in his own country's prisons. And he also says, what about Haider al-Abdi's mass hangings in Iraq, or that nasty little Poth death crucifixion in Saudi Arabia last week, not to mention the horrid war in Yemen where kids are being killed all the time, or the Israeli habit of shooting down scores of unarmed Palestinians in Gaza, or the chump Fisk describes him as in North Korea, who appeals to Trump's sense of humour.
Well, I mean, in a sense, Fisk is right about this. This is propaganda. Why do we hear about Erdogan? Because he's been singled out to be bullied by the Western powers. And we hear nothing about Sisi because he's aligned with us. And we hear nothing about Saudi Arabia because we're aligned with them and we're implicated in the killings that are going on in Yemen. But Erdogan has now, because he's moving out of the Western orbit, he's suddenly become public enemy number one. And of course, the day before yesterday, he was our best mate. and he was helping us to infiltrate Al-Qaeda into Syria from all over the world, Libya in particular, Abdul Hakim Belhaj, for example, and from Libya. And when he was on our side, all of his bad behaviour was completely ignored. Now he's starting to do things that the Western powers don't like. Suddenly we're reminded what a terrible guy he is.
This chap is called Pastor Andrew Brunson, who's been put under house arrest by Erdogan. But the consequences, we're being told to believe, are enormous. That the Americans have doubled US tariffs on steel and aluminium, and helped to almost entirely crash the Turkish lira, which lost 45% of its value this year.
Yes, and it's the courts which have refused to release Pastor Brunson because they claim that he's a CIA agent and that he was involved in the coup. And you know what, Tony? It may very well be the case.
So is it just because Erdogan doesn't like Christians?
No, it's because Erdogan doesn't like the CIA trying to overthrow him and nearly kill him. They intended to kill him, but because the Russians tipped him off, he managed to deal with the coup attempt.
Anyway, but
hundreds of people died in that coup attempt. It wasn't a bloodless coup attempt. Loads of people were killed.
What Robert Fisk by NATO. Then attempts to do is to name what he believes are the real reasons. He doesn't believe it's anything to do with this pastor whatsoever. Firstly, buying the Russian S-400 missile system. Now, why might that be a reason to have an economic war on Turkey?
Because what Turkey is doing is trying to spread its bets. So it's been in the Western pocket for years, and they got involved in Syria on the understanding that they would get what they wanted with Assad, but then, of course, it didn't work out. And don't forget that the Russians helped Erdogan when he was about to be overthrown by the coup. And he's basically trying to, he's trying to get friends all over the place. Why just be friends with the Americans when I can be friends with the Russians, friends with the Chinese? And the future of Turkey lies with being friends with the Russians and the Chinese. The past of Turkey is being in the pocket of the West and having various military governments which have oppressed the people for years.
Why would it so upset the Americans?
Because they don't.
He's only trying to be friends.
Yes, but they don't forget they're trying to frustrate the Chinese One Belt One Road project. They're trying to recolonize Russia, get rid of Putin, and Erdogan suddenly turned out to be not a reliable partner from their point of view. Now, what's going on is everybody's having, they used to say that there's only one thing worse than being America's enemy, and that's being America's friend. And, of course, if you're America's friend, they just drop you like a hot potato when they've decided they don't like you anymore.
Or they also they do an attempted coup.
Or they do an attempted coup to get rid of you, that's right.
What about the fact that Erdogan is refusing to accept the US support for the American Kurdish YPGs, allies?
Well, of course, that was bound to be a tension, because the YPG in Syria is aligned with the PKK, and the PKK have been there's been a horrible war going on in eastern Turkey in which tens of thousands have died. Diyarbakir has been reduced to rubble, but of course we've heard nothing at all about that because Turkey's on our side and part of NATO, and therefore he's not being accused of being a baby killer like Assad, although that may change. But of course there was always going to be tension about this because the only people who would work with the Americans in northern Syria were the YPG, but I understand from look at this week, the YPG have switched sides and they're now aligned with the Syrians, Syrian government.
One of the things that Robert Fisk says in this article today is that it was the Russians and Iranians who first warned Erdogan of the impending coup 2 years ago against him in July 2016. They had been listening, apparently, to the Turkish military internal radio traffic and tipped him off.
Yes.
Is that true?
As far as I know, it is true. And, of course, Erdogan then owes Putin and he owes Rouhani. He owes him something. So now what Turkey could be doing now is moving out of the Western camp and into the opposite camp.
How come they're still in NATO then?
Well, they're not going to stay in NATO much longer if they keep taking Russia. I mean, he's buying in these Russian anti-aircraft stuff so that he can shoot down American planes. If there's any further, and Incirlik, his legal lawyers close to the government have said that they want to go into Incirlik Air Base and arrest various people, military personnel, American military personnel, who they think were involved in the coup. And the Incirlik Air Base is actually very crucial to.
I think it's pronounced Incirlik, actually.
it's very crucial to the projection of power by the US into the Middle East, and they could lose the base. But of course, they can always have another attempted coup, or they could just bring Erdogan down by making the population rise up against him because they've impoverished them by putting sanctions on them. But I think that they may be overplaying their hand here. Erdogan simply turn around to the people who voted for him and say, you know why you're suffering? It's because the Yanks have put sanctions on us. Maybe we should leave NATO. And maybe that's it. Maybe NATO should just disappear. There's no purpose for NATO other than trying to oppress the people who are all over the world. I mean, NATO is fighting a war in the Hindu Kush, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Apparently, according to Robert Fisk, another thing Erdogan is doing, which is getting up Trump's nose, is helping Iran to dodge the US sanctions,
yes,
which were imposed after they tore up the 2015 nuclear agreement.
Well, you've got to recognize that countries like Iraq and Turkey actually have a border with Iran, and they do quite a lot of business with them. If the US puts sanctions on Iran, they don't do any business with them, so they don't lose any money. It's everybody else who loses money. So they're basically being told you can't have what would be perfectly straightforward economic relations with your neighbours, because if you do, then we're going to put sanctions on
you. What Fisk says is that Erdogan, in a decision demonstrating the cowardly response of the EU's own oil conglomerates to Trump's insanity, that's Fisk's word, has announced that he will continue to import Iranian oil. Thus, will Washington's further threat of increased oil sanctions against Iran be blunted?
Well, that's right. So, in other words, Turkey is now...
Why is the European Union going along with Trump?
The European Union has said that the European Union has said that they're not going to... they're going to encourage their companies to carry on doing business.
Encourage is one thing, though, but we know that any of the companies that do business with Iran will get sanctions imposed on them from the States.
That's the problem, because if you're a company doing business in the United States...
So the EU is effectively talking out of two sides of its face at the same time. It's saying one side, it's saying it's fine, British and all other European Union countries can trade with Iran, but actually the fact of the matter is they aren't going to be able to, and actually the EU is doing nothing about it.
Well, that's because the EU is in a weak position. Don't forget who really runs the EU and who really runs NATO, and it ain't the EU, it's the Americans. The Americans are, and Trump is making it absolutely clear, we're the boss, you do as we say or else. And in the past they used to try and pretend that there was some kind of consensus being made, we will take your views into account. That's no longer the case. The EU is not in a position to fight a trade war with Trump unless they break with NATO. And ultimately, of course, this is what this could lead to. NATO could be destroyed. It should be destroyed.
Erdogan has made good friends out of Putin and Iran's supreme leader, and as an opponent of Saudi Arabia, is naturally on the best of terms with Qatar, whose emir, in a miraculous moment which even Pastor Brunson might envy, has just promised an investment of $15 billion in Turkey. Saudi Arabia's siege of Qatar is beginning to look as miserable as its war against the Shiites of Yemen. So there's this quite amazing alliance building between Qatar, which of course is where Al Jazeera is based, and the Turks.
It is, and of course previously Qatar and Turkey were very involved in the overthrow of Gaddafi. They've been very involved in the attempted overthrow of Assad, but they're now wising up and realising that being a cat's paw for the Americans ain't got a future.
Turkish troops are stationed in Qatar to protect the little emirate against its larger and threatening neighbour, Saudi Arabia. Well, is that a good idea? The emir might find those Turkish troops are starting to order him around.
Well, I think he was quite happy when they turned up. And of course, you've got to remember that Erdogan's AJP party is aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, which of course makes Egypt is not very happy because they're aligned with Saudi Arabia because they're against the Muslim Brotherhood. This is Middle Eastern politics. It's complicated. There's not just one lot of forces that on one side and one lot on the other. You've got multiple fractures and people trying to work out what their interests really are. But of course, what's actually underpinning all of this is that the Western powers and Al-Qaeda lost the war in Syria, and therefore there's been a change in the Rubik's Cube.
Talking of Syria, Russian troops are now patrolling the Syrian-Israeli lines below the occupied Golan Heights. The Russians have promised Israel that the comparatively few Iranian forces in Syria will be kept at least 50 miles from this sector. Russia's ally Syria needs to crush the final Islamist stronghold in Idlib with Russia's help and push the province's most intransigent fighters, Fisk says, back into Turkey. Qatar has the cash to rebuild Syria and thus extend its influence across the landmass of the Levant to the Mediterranean. If Qatar's going to pour even more billions into Turkey, we may see some kind of strategic alliance between Doha and Ankara and a rediscovery of the family friendship between Erdogan and Assad.
Well, that's right, because previously Erdogan said Erdogan's policy is we're friendly to all of our neighbouring states. We're not going to get involved in trying to overthrow anybody. But he was persuaded by the British and the Americans to get involved in this madcap scheme to remove Assad. And of course, it was quite clear that it was NATO intelligence services which began the uprising in Syria and then infiltrated tens of thousands of crazies, some of them from Uyghur parts of China, into Syria to overthrow the democratically elected government, because they had a 2012 election in which Assad won handsomely, unlike Sisi, who's had an election, but the opposition were completely banned and less than half the population voted. But of course, we're allied with Sisi, so we don't hear about that. He's killed thousands of people, but we don't hear anything about that because he's on our side.
What about this business with the Golan Heights? Because we know that Murdoch and others have got oil franchises sitting there, but this is actually not officially Israeli territory. They took it in the 1967 Six-Day War, I believe, and yet they're now selling oil franchises to people like Rupert Murdoch.
Well, in international law, it doesn't belong to them, it belongs to Syria. And Assad has always said that when we've finished dealing with the terrorists inside Syria, it may be time for us to take back the Golan Heights. And the Israelis have got not a leg to stand on here. It doesn't belong to them. And so, yes, but we need it, because otherwise we might come under attack. And, of course, they've been supporting the jihadis inside Syria. That's why the white helmets were evacuated from northern Syria via southern Syria via the Golan Heights by the Israelis. They've been providing all kinds of support to jihadis, Saudi-aligned al-Nusra, al-Qaeda jihadis inside Syria. And, people in the Middle East actually know what goes on. People in Britain in general don't know what anything of this is about. They think that we're against Islamist terrorism, when in actual fact we finance and orchestrate it, and they just don't know the history. And, of course, the Israelis are a democracy, unlike Syria, etc. It's a complete farce, but that's the sort of stuff that, people are spoon-fed in the bubble of Middle England and Middle America.
Times of Israel today, Martin's reporting that in the Golan Heights, Russia is seeking a handover to UN peacekeepers in the area, and they have their own patrols now running along the border.
That's right. They're trying to get back to the status quo ante, which is where the Syrian government controlled all the way up to the border, and the Israelis were in control of the Golan Heights. But it's still not satisfactory for the Israelis being in control of the Golan Heights. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, we said Kuwait doesn't belong to you. You've got to give it back. But when the Israelis invade something, oh no, you can keep that. And they're actually planning to completely annex it and make it part of Israel, even though the population isn't Israeli.
Well, on Tuesday,
they're moving settlers in there.
The United Nations has got very different ideas, because on Tuesday this week, UN delegates in Damascus discussed peacekeepers in the Golan Heights demilitarised zone for the first time for many years. A delegation of UN commanders visited Damascus for talks with the Syrian Defence Minister Ali Abdullah Ayyub on the redeployment of the world's body's peacekeepers to the volatile demilitarised zone in the Israeli-occupied Syria Golan Heights. So is it feasible that the UN actually might do something after, what if it's 67, 70, 80, 90, that's what, nearly 50 years?
Well, the UN was used to have a tripwire force there, and they had one in South Lebanon as well. Ultimately, that's still not correct, because the Golan Heights do, and don't forget the Golan Heights have got lots of oil underneath them, and that oil could be used to rebuild Syria after the Israelis and the Western powers and Al-Qaeda have killed loads of people and smashed the infrastructure. They need that oil to rebuild. Why should the Israelis, who smashed Syria up, have that oil? That's not fair, that's not reasonable, and ultimately there's going to be a major Middle East war, and the Israelis have got to lose it.
We've got an interesting situation here with the Russians on one side and the Israelis on the other.
Well, that's what's making the situation calmer, because the Russians are trying to calm everybody down. They're trying to interpose themselves into the situation and say to the Israelis, you back off, and saying to the Iranians, you back off. But ultimately, of course, that's not really fair, because the Israelis are the aggressors. They seize that land. It doesn't belong to them. It should go back to the people it does belong to.
All's fair, Martin, in love and war. You know that.
Well,
it's
indeed.
What you can get away with.
It's what you can get away with. But, of course, ultimately, if you carry on cheating, lying, stealing, ultimately you might lose. And that's what the Israelis have got to consider.
Now, we heard last week from Eilat Shaked. She's the Justice Minister from Israel. And I think we might have a series of these. Have a listen to some of these people and what they've got to say from the Israeli cabinet. And this week we're going to hear a bit about their policy to... I mean, because we've had such a horrific situation back in April and May this year with so many people, unarmed civilians, being shot dead by the Israeli forces. I wonder how this fits into their so-called... called Homeland Security, which is a sort of, I guess it's like a sort of armed wing of the Home Office in Israel. So let's have a listen now to the Homeland Security Minister, Gilad Erdan, see what he's got to say about the way they're dealing with what they call is the terrorism by the Palestinians.
The two defining characteristics of the new wave of terror are, as I mentioned yesterday, one, the central role of incitement and radicalization, especially online, and two, the simplicity of the attacks which are carried out by individuals with easily accessible weapons and without the command and control structures of traditional terrorist groups. Or to put it another way, high-tech communications and low-tech operations. Since the start of the wave of lone wolf terror in Israel began September 2015, we've experienced hundreds of serious terror attacks. In the period leading up to the outbreak of these attacks, and especially in the first half year of the terror wave, we were witness to an intense campaign of online and real-world incitement. This incitement, which continues as we speak, has a number of themes. Some are religious, such as the absurd and absolutely false libel that Israel plans to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. While this libel has no basis in reality, we saw it. It has led young religious Muslims to attack Jews, in order, as they see it, to defend Al-Aqsa. Another theme is the glorification of terrorists. Those who've carried out murderous attacks are celebrated as heroes, martyrs, shahids, online and in the streets. This incitement also included an intense campaign of delegitimization against the very existence of the State of Israel. And, as you all know, when you delegitimize a country or its culture or its values, you basically legitimize violence against it. We have taken a number of steps to counter this incitement. None of these steps were simple. They not only presented operational challenges, but, as you know, many raise dilemmas that go to the heart of the balance that we all believe that is needed, between the right to free speech, for example, and the right to personal safety, between the individual's right to privacy, for example, another example, and the public's right to go about daily life without fear.
Well, the irony there, Martin, is he's talking about this September 2015. That was the Israeli Homeland Security Minister Gilad Erdan speaking just a few weeks ago. This was kind of put across as well. This was a Islamic mob, an Arab mob that the Israelis had to put down, and that it sparked off a whole load of knife attacks by Arabs on Israelis. But if you actually go back and have a look, you'll find that it was the main problem there was that the Israeli soldiers had actually stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Now, this is incredibly important contested territory here, this Temple Mount space, isn't it? And at the time, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the attack on Al-Aqsa following clashes at one of Islam's holiest sites. So a lot of it does seem to be based around Al-Aqsa, and it's difficult to extricate it. Whereas he's saying there that actually the idea that the Israeli state wants to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a libel. So where do you stand on? Where do you think?
Well,
how do you make sense of this?
Well, let's put it this way, settlers and extremist Israelis have been constantly trying to enter the Al-Aqsa compound. Ariel Sharon went there with a load of settlers before the first Intifada in the 90s.
Just go back to September 2015. What you had was actually Israeli soldiers in the mosque.
Yeah, well, they go in with the settlers to protect them from being attacked by the Muslims, and that means that they're basically taking over the area. Now, of course, don't forget that the Israelis are not supposed to be in Jerusalem at all. The original borders of the Israeli state were all
focus on Al-Aqsa for a minute, mm-hmm. as he was doing, right? The Israeli security personnel used tear gas and stun grenades as they entered the compound to arrest what they call Palestinian stone throwers. So maybe they were children who'd run into the mosque.
Yeah, but
surely the authorities got a right to run into the church.
Well, no, I come back to my initial point. When the State of Israel was recognised in 1948, it was given clear borders, and the borders definitely did not include Jerusalem. And, of course, they captured West Jerusalem in the 1967 war, and then they claimed that they were going to keep it. Now, in actual fact, if you take something in war and say, well, I've taken it in war, but we're going to keep it, well, the answer is, we're going to take it off you in war, and you're not going to have it, because there are no rules. You can just take what you want and you can keep it. We're at war with you. And therefore, don't complain if somebody stabs one of your soldiers with a knife, because that's what's going to happen if you've got a war, isn't it? And, of course, all of the settlers' villages in the West Bank, do you know what they're justified by under Israeli law? They're justified as necessary for military purposes, that they need to have settlements in the West Bank for military reasons to keep the population under control.
Well, the settlers were very much involved in this incident back in September 2015.
But that means the
manager of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Omar Kiswani, said to Al Jazeera that 80 Jewish settlers protected by the Israeli police attacked the mosque when confronted by Palestinian volunteer guards. A statement issued by the Israeli police said that masked protesters who were inside the mosque threw stones and fireworks at the police. So, I mean, you know, I guess this is just like, which side do you believe?
Indeed, and I come back to the main point, which is, should the Israelis be in Jerusalem at all? And, of course, when the UN recognised Israel in 1948, it was given clear borders, or anywhere else. But they've never stayed within those borders.
Jewish homeland, Martin.
Well, what's the border of that Jewish homeland? They don't think...
It must include Jerusalem,
no,
surely.
No, it doesn't. No, in 1948...
That's the Jewish capital.
No, it doesn't matter. But in 1948, there was not a big Jewish community in Jerusalem. There was no just as there's not a big Serbian community in Kosovo, but we went to war with Serbia to prevent them having Kosovo. We dropped thousands of tons of bombs on them and killed thousands of civilians because Serbia was not allowed to have Kosovo. It used to be part of Kosovo, but now it hasn't got a Serbian majority. It's got an overwhelming Albanian Muslim majority, and we went to war with Serbia. And you know who didn't support the war with Serbia over that? The Israelis, because they knew exactly what the principle being created was, that you're not to have land grabs in the 21st century. Now, in actual fact, the Israelis have got to give up land grabs. The border between Gaza and Israel, the people in Gaza used to live on the farms which the Israelis claim are theirs. And they say that the border between Gaza and them is a border. It's not a border, it's a ceasefire line. Now, in actual fact, there's never been a peace deal signed between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That means that everybody's at war, and the Israelis are going to have to stay at war until they play by the rules.
Gilad Erdan, we just heard from there, also was talking about online radicalisation. He's saying that this is one of the main things that they've got to stop, people getting radicalised online, although the evidence does seem to be that people are quite radical anyway.
Well, they would be. If you go around shooting people and oppressing them, they tend to get radicalised, don't they? That's what happened to the Jewish settlers in the 1940s.
Answer,
the Irgun and the Haganah went around killing British soldiers because they were radicalised.
His answer seems to be to send little messages over to Mark Zuckerberg saying, please remove this website from Facebook.
Ahmed Tamimi had a Facebook account closed and all the rest of it. What they want to do is they want to control the narrative about what's going on. And, of course, when he talks about their delegitimization of the Israeli state, that is absolutely freedom of speech. The Israeli state was recognized within certain agreed borders in 1948. They have never agreed to settle for those borders. That means that the state is illegitimate and ultimately should be de-recognized by the United Nations. I say that absolutely openly. That's not an anti-Semitic position. That's a political position. And in Britain, we've got a particular responsibility because we agreed to hand over the Palestinian land to these to the Zionist occupiers that are now occupying.
I thought we were just driven out out by a military means.
No, but in 1917 we agreed that the Balfour Declaration was put together by the British and the Americans and the Zionists to create an Israeli state. And I think if the Israeli state continues to be an aggressive state, a problem in the Middle East, to the extent that it creates radicalisation so that we're being blown up in Britain because of the radicalisation caused by the Israelis, then we've got a vested interest in making sure they behave themselves for just looking after our own
best
interests.
Well, you're not the only person that thinks that, Martin, because also there's this chap who is the World Jewish Congress president. He's announced this week that he fears the impact of the Israeli government's destructive actions, which is a fairly strong statement for the president of the World Jewish Congress, Ronald S. Lauder. He's warned that the Israeli government, the likely impact of its destructive actions on the state's relationship with Jews worldwide. Writing in the New York Times, he argues Israel's government to listen to the voices of protest and outrage being heard in Israel and throughout the Jewish world. In particular, Lauder cites the decision in 2017 to withdraw from an agreement that would create an egalitarian prayer area at the Western Wall and propose a strict conversion law that impinges on the rights of non-Orthodox Jews. The president also pointed to steps taken this year, including a law denying equal rights to same-sex couples and the nation state law, legislation that may have severe national and international repercussions.
Well, he's a moderate Zionist, and what he's saying is if you carry on being extreme, as the Israeli government currently is, then the question of whether Israel should be there at all is going to come onto the agenda. And I'm afraid I'm already there. There is a question whether they should be there at all.
I mean, why haven't we heard? We've heard a lot about Jeremy Corbyn. We haven't heard this, have we? According to him, many Jews now wonder if the nation they cherish is losing its way.
Well, that's because there used to be a liberal support for Israel on the basis that it was a democratic state with a strong labour movement, etc. But that's long gone. The Israelis themselves have killed off the two-state solution that everybody was talking about as a compromise. Now, if there's no two-state solution, then we're going back to a straightforward... Everybody is going to have to be a one-state solution. The Israelis can stay there, the Palestinians can come back from wherever they've gone, and then we'll have a democratic election and we'll see who runs Israel Palestine. And of course, in numerical terms, it won't be the Jewish population, it'll be the Arab Muslim population, who are always the majority.
The BBC this week, according to the Middle East Monitor, has bowed to pressure from Israel and changed a Gaza headline. The BBC once again has come under sharp criticism over its coverage of violence perpetrated by Israel against the Palestinians. Critics called the BBC out over its bias after the broadcaster bowed to pressure from the Israel Foreign Ministry changed the headline of a news piece concerning Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. The BBC headline read, "Israel airstrikes kill woman and baby," for a news piece related to the killing of three Palestinians, including a pregnant mother and a toddler in Gaza on Wednesday night. The headline attracted the attention of Israel's foreign ministry, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, who's leading a bitter campaign against Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, and the Foreign Ministry spokesman Emmanuel Nashon shot the BBC down and demanded for the headline to be changed immediately. So Israel airstrikes kill pregnant woman and baby then got changed I'll tell you what it got changed to in a minute, but this is a bit concerning. When a foreign government can just contact a state broadcaster and tell them to change a headline like this,
well, and then they give in and change it. I mean, they can contact them if they like, but the BBC shouldn't give in to that kind of pressure. But, of course, it does. And that's, of course, over time, creates a situation where the Israeli point of view and their way of looking at the world becomes ingrained in everybody else's point of view. And, of course, that's just not right. It's just not right. They're basically making special pleading all the time. And, of course, when they're using aircraft here. They're using aircraft on Gaza. And, of course, the Gazans have got no aircraft. When Gaddafi did that, we went to war with him. When Serbia did that in Kosovo, we went to war with them. But the Israelis not only use aircraft on civilians, we pat them on the back and say, "There, there, never mind." Now, this is totally incompatible. And of course, in actual fact, the smart Israelis know very well that the war in Yugoslavia created the principle that there should be no ethnic cleansing. And that means, in actual fact, that a lot of Israel is an ethnically cleansed, unlegitimate state.
Let me just clarify this. The two headlines. First, it was Israeli airstrikes kill three, including pregnant mother and toddler in Gaza. That was then changed to Gaza airstrikes kill woman and child after rockets hit Israel.
Yes. So, in other words, they say that they're trying to make it seem as if they're responding to some rocket attack, but of course, that's not even the case. The airstrike was nothing to do with the rocket attack.
Well, it might have been just a response to it. I mean, that may be correct.
No, it may be correct, and it may not be. And in any case, the BBC should be allowed to have their headline if it's true. And of course, the fact of the matter is that most of the people in Gaza used to live on the other side of the fence in that part of Israel, which Israel claims. They actually literally used to live in those farms.
Well, look,
it's their land that's been taken off.
It's really hotting up over there because this week we've had an Israeli minister saying Iran should disappear from the world. Iran should entirely disappear from the world. That's what Israeli Minister of Public Security Gilad Erdan, that chap we were hearing from earlier, had to say when asked about US President Donald Trump's decision on Monday to reimpose anti-Iran sanctions that were lifted under a historic nuclear deal between Tehran and six world powers. That story was actually just this week, even though, of course, the Iran deal was dumped many months ago. So is that okay for the Israeli minister to say Iran should disappear from the world?
Well,
it's been there for quite a few millennia, hasn't it?
It has, and I would suggest that that's the sort of thing that if Jeremy Corbyn said it, it'd be calls for resignation. But when an Israeli politician says it, it's just, oh dear, never mind. Now, the fact is that the extreme right in Israel have taken control of the situation. They're already in possession of lots of land they shouldn't have, and you know, through various wars. They're far more in defiance of international norms, far more than Serbia was in the 1990s. When are we going to war with Israel? Because we're going to have
Martin,
to in the end, aren't
we? Top Syrian scientist is killed and fingers point at Israel. We hear August the 6th in the New York Times. Aziz Asbar was one of Syria's most important rocket scientists, bent on amassing an arsenal of precision-guided missiles that could be launched with pinpoint accuracy against Israeli cities hundreds of miles away. And he's been killed. But I think it was Charles Shoebridge that rather cleverly pointed out that, interesting, that the killing was claimed by a group linked to al-Qaeda, which might suggest, as often, Israeli al-Qaeda cooperation.
Indeed. Indeed, Charles Shoebridge, of course, used to be an anti-terrorist officer here in the Metropolitan Police. Al-Qaeda is a creation of the Saudis, the Western Intelligence Services, and Mossad. And therefore, Al-Qaeda, when it carries out attacks in Syria or in the West, is actually working with the Israeli intelligence services and with our own intelligence services. They are the terrorists.
Isn't it better that
we are at war with
Isn't
them.
It better that these people get killed before they build these awful weapons?
Well, in that case, what we need to be seeing is some selective assassination of Israeli officials and military personnel.
I mean, it does suggest...
Because they're the ones behind it all. Al-Qaeda is run by Mossad. Never mind killing individual members of Al-Qaeda. Let's find the generals in Mossad who are running Al-Qaeda and assassinate them. Maybe Navy SEAL team should go in there and sort them out.
Martin, what's alleged is that this guy was actually running a chemical weapons facility.
Well, we don't know the truth of what he was or what he was doing, although there's a book come out recently you'll be aware of, Tony, where they admit they've been involved in at least 2,500 assassinations across the Middle East in the last 10 years. They claim to be a democratic state, but they're involved in 2,500 assassinations. If their politicians and leaders were being assassinated, they'd scream blue murder and say it's all terrorism. When they do it, it's fine.
So are Israel and Syria at war?
No, they're not at war because there was a ceasefire signed in 1973, which settled it was a ceasefire. But it wasn't a peace deal, just a ceasefire. And of course, they've been intervening in the Syrian war to protect their protégés, including al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda. And everybody in Syria and the Middle East knows very well that al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, is Mossad, is MI6, is CIA. It's all the same stuff.
The Middle East Eye has been saying this week the Israel lobby is leading a witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn, and it has to stop. Britain's Labour Party's tearing itself apart over anti-Semitism charges disingenuously cooked up by political opponents. So Richard Silverstein in the Middle East Eye, in order to understand the true motivation behind Labour's anti-Semitism charges, it's important to focus less on the actual charges and more on the organisations making them, he says.
That's right. Well, Silverstein is a very honourable Jewish professor in the United States who actually lost his position in the university because of his opposition to Israeli policy. His parents died in the Holocaust. He's an absolutely honourable man, and he's basically pointing out the truth. The truth is that the Israeli state is far too big for its boots. They intervene in everybody's business. They tell the BBC what to do. They run Al Qaeda. They carry out assassinations, and many, of course, of the more extreme Islamist groups which they're opposing them are actually run by Shin Bet and Mossad anyway.
Again, back to Middle East Monitor, and Lieberman says war on Gaza is just a matter of time. It's only a matter of time before Israel launches a new offensive against the Gaza Strip. Defence Minister Avigdor Lieberman said yesterday, the Jerusalem Post reported him saying, the question of the next round of fighting is not whether, but when.
Yes, and if they use air power, no doubt the RAF will go in and shoot them down like they did in Libya. And then we'll bomb the Israeli military facilities until they agree to withdraw. That's what we did in Libya. That's what we did in Serbia. Surely we'll do that to the Israelis, won't we? If we're going to be fair about people who use overwhelming force against civilians. But of course, that's not going to happen, is it? Ultimately, of course, what may happen is they do go to war with Iran and lose, because Hezbollah defeated them in 2006, and they don't. In actual fact, they can't win a war with Iran. So maybe it's time for bring it on.
Do you think that's an awful thing to say? Because there would be thousands, possibly tens of thousands, killed in Gaza.
Well,
why is it military fighting civilian population like that?
Because war in the modern era, Tony, 80% of the casualties are civilian. That was the same in the Second World War. It's the same in every war since. War kills civilians. Some of those civilians have got credit cards and friends in America, and they're real people. And some of the civilians are just poor, and they haven't even got access to the internet, so they don't count. Yeah, like children in Yemen, they're not real people. They're not real people that go shopping in shopping malls like in Israel.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we turn to look at China, because there's been a UN report this week which has pointed out that there are actually up to 1 million people in Xinjiang province, I think it's called, in the west of the country, who there are attempts to de-Islamify them. Now, Martin, this does sound a little bit sinister. I know you're a big fan of China generally. And also, at the same time, we've had the speech by the independence movement in the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, which is supposed to... I mean, the Chinese have got very upset about that. They don't want any talk about independence. That seems to be completely off limits. And at the same time, the Chinese have been doing their biggest military exercises ever right next to Hong Kong. It's almost as if this is... It's almost inevitable there's going to be some sort of clash or conflict of some kind between the kind of remnants of the Western ideas of freedom of speech and being able to say things, even if you haven't got any political power. The Chinese don't like that at all.
They don't like it in Saudi Arabia, do they, either? But we're not invading Saudi Arabia, although the British Navy and the...
Can we talk about China, please?
No, yes, we're talking about... No, we just mentioned it in comparison to other places. Why are we hearing about freedom of speech in China and not in Saudi Arabia?
Well, because there isn't freedom of speech in China.
Well, there isn't freedom of speech in Saudi Arabia, but we're aligned with them and we're helping in their war with Yemen. When are we going to stop doing that, Tony?
So is it okay to hold, as we're being told by Al Jazeera, 1 million Muslims in China's secret re-education camps?
Well, I've read some things about what goes on in that part of the world, and of course some people in that province do not want to be part of China, but some of them are also engaged in terrorist activities in order to try and bring that freedom about.
A million people?
There was a million people. They say 1 million people have been put in through re-education. In other words, they're trying to persuade them.
Okay, so this is detention. Let's just make it clear. Yeah. More than 1 million Uyghur Muslims are estimated to be in detention in counter-extremism centres in China's far west, the vice chairperson of the UN Anti-Discrimination Committee has said this week.
Yes, indeed. And of course, there's also strong evidence that the Turks, for example, the Grey Wolves in Turkey, the right-wing groups associated with the military, have been... arming and training terrorists in that part of China to attack the security forces and police stations. And of course, many of them have been sent via Turkey into Syria and are fighting in Syria with Al Qaeda.
We're not talking about Syria.
No,
right?
we're talking about Uyghurs. Uyghurs are in Syria. Quite a lot of them are in Syria.
We're talking about China, Martin. Yes, okay. And in China, do you think it's okay to make the disrespect of President Xi or the national anthem a crime with up to three? You can do up to 3 years in jail for?
No, China is not a Western democracy, Tony, nor is Saudi Arabia. But we're in alliance with one and we're opposed to another. We're actually opposed to what the Chinese are doing, which is constructive. When he said about they're having the biggest exercises ever on their coast, that's because the West has had the biggest exercises ever on their coast. We've sent our ships from Britain to China to have an exercise right on the Chinese coast. What if the Chinese Navy turned up in the channel? What would we think of that? Would that be fair? Well, I mean, it's an international waterway, but if they turned up mob-handed with aircraft carriers in the channel, would we like that? Or would we say that's not reasonable? But that's what we're doing. And, of course, what they're trying to do is overthrow the communist government of China. And they're
Do you think there's any likelihood of some kind of real conflict, war, whatever, breaking out in that part of the world?
Absolutely. Because the whole situation around the world now is a complete powder keg. Now, China is not a democratic country. But if you think the majority of Chinese won't support their communist government if it goes to war with the West, you're deluded. They will. They will.
Chinese surveillance has been expanding to Muslims who are making the Mecca pilgrimage. We've heard a couple of months ago, I'm not sure the actual date of that, that was actually 31st of July. China's close watch over its Islamic minority is being extended abroad as Muslims from Chinese regions make the Hajj pilgrimage wearing state-issued tracking devices. I mean, can't do that sort of thing over here, do we?
Well, no, but they're going to Saudi Arabia. Remember with Saudi Arabia I was mentioning earlier? These Chinese pilgrims are going to Saudi Arabia where they will no doubt come into contact with Saudi intelligence and Al-Qaeda, and then they come back to China. Now, of course, we're keeping pretty good watch on the Muslim community in this country because we think fear that they may do something.
Well, we don't actually seem to be keeping that good a watch because many of them, these terrorist attacks that we've had, particularly the ones last year just before the general election, is that there was a perfectly large amount of warning because the MI5 had been informed about these individuals.
Yes, because in actual fact, most Al-Qaeda-linked groups are working with Western intelligence services, but you can bet your bottom dollar that the Chinese intelligence services know exactly that. They know that Al-Qaeda is the Western intelligence services and the Western intelligence services are Al-Qaeda, and they know, because we've been pretty clear about it, that we want to overthrow their government. We want to get rid of the communist government of China.
I would suggest a very good force for the place to look for this stuff is the South China Morning Post, which is Hong Kong based, I believe. Taiwan has revealed a deterrent to China as satellite images show missile capable of targeting the mainland. Land attack cruise missiles would be capable of targeting Hong Kong and other coastal cities, but China has apparently got the defense systems to intercept it. Now, so these are now in place, these cruise missiles in Taiwan.
Well, there's a potential for a war in the South China Sea. There's a potential for a war in the Uyghur region of China. And there's a potential for a war in Kurdistan. I mean, don't forget the Turks, because the Uyghurs speak a Turkic language. And of course, some of them have been infiltrated into Syria via Turkey. And of course, the Saudis are the place where Al-Qaeda was born. And if these people go to the Hajj, to Mecca, they could easily come into contact with Saudi intelligence. And the Saudis, of course, they're not a democratic country either, Tony, and they don't allow freedom of speech. And it could very well be that the people that go there to get support from the Saudi intelligence, they don't believe in freedom of speech either.
A lot of the sort of control freakery coming from Beijing is started in the spring when China's President Xi Jinping introduced a 5-year plan to Sinicize all the nation's religions by infusing them with Chinese characteristics such as loyalty to the Communist Party and to him. Over the last few months, the government's taken steps towards this measure by shutting down hundreds of private Christian house churches and also seizing Bibles. Now, what's that got to do with stopping terrorism?
Let's put it this way, Tony. If there was a less aggressive attitude towards the Chinese communist government and we were all cooperating on building the One Belt, One Road project and cooperating together, whether the Chinese government could afford to be more liberal in its attitude to its opponents. But since there is actually an ongoing war of words between the Chinese communists, who are aligned with the Russian Democrats against us, they are taking a they're taking a paranoid attitude because they've got every reason to believe that there is going to be attempts to overthrow them.
How does that extend to, in March this year, a prominent Chinese house church leader was sentenced to 7 years in jail for building a Christian school in Burma?
Well, this is the Chinese government leaning on its political opponents. But of course, you can't build any Christian schools in Saudi Arabia, our allies. You're not allowed to show any kind of Christianity at all. It's forbidden, completely forbidden, Tony. But they're our allies. When are we going to war with them?
The surveillance state, I mean, it sounds a little bit like Amazon, actually, what they're doing over there in some factories. You have to wear a hat, which monitors your mood in China. And if it looks like you're getting too tense, you can lose your job.
China is not a democratic country. Why are we talking about China as opposed to Saudi Arabia, which actually invaded Yemen?
We talk about Saudi Arabia
The point is, all of this links together, yeah? All of this links together. We were talking about Turkey at the beginning of the hour. Turkey supports Uyghur separatists in China, just as the Chinese will no doubt be supporting the Kurdish separatists against the Turks, if that's the way the cookie crumbles. And in actual fact, there's just a load of hypocrisy about all of this from the West. The Chinese just think, when we go on about human rights, we're the ones with Guantanamo Bay. We're the ones with hundreds of people, thousands of people in these secret prisons all over the world. We're the ones who are running Al-Qaeda
to try and overthrow
Gaddafi. But we go on about...
Some of the surveillance stuff the Chinese are up to. Facial recognition tech is now used for everything in China, from catching criminals in huge crowds to detecting and shaming jaywalkers to deciding whether someone can get an extra square of toilet paper in the public bathroom. Some employees have to wear helmets, as I said, that scan their brainwaves for rage, depression, anxiety or fatigue, and that alert their bosses to any perceived problems. Then there's the country's social credit system, which monitors millions of individuals' behaviour, including on social media and online shopping, and determines how moral or immoral it is, and then raises or lowers their citizen score accordingly. Those with a high score are rewarded. Those with a low score are punished. They're also using drones a lot over there now for surveillance, and I might put a link up on our show page to their new drone, which looks like a flying pigeon. Anyway, that's all, Martin. Time for the Murdoch News at 8 now. This show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details are at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us at the Politics Show, 6 o'clock next week. God bless. Don't let the banksters get you down.
Station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.